Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. One's mind is always agitated by the passionate mode of material nature and bewildered by the ignorant mode of nature. But one can rectify such conceptions by the relation of Vishnu and thus become pacified by cleansing the dirty things created by them. Purport. Persons generally conducted by the modes of passion and ignorance cannot be bona fide candidates for being situated in the transcendental stage of God-realization. Only persons conducted by the mode of goodness can have the knowledge of the Supreme Truth. Effects of the mode of passion and ignorance are manifested by too much hankering after wealth and women. And those who are too much after wealth and women can rectify their learnings only by constant remembrance of Vishnu in His potential impersonal feature. Generally, the impersonalists or monists are influenced by the modes of passion and ignorance. Such impersonalists think of themselves as liberated souls, but they have no knowledge of transcendental personal feature of the Absolute Truth. Actually, they are impure in heart on account of being devoid of knowledge of the personal feature of the Absolute. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said that after many hundreds of births, the impersonal philosopher surrenders unto the personality of Godhead. To acquire such a qualification of God realization in the personal feature, the neophyte impersonalist is given a chance to realize the relation of the Lord in everything by the philosophy of pantheism. Pantheism, in its higher status, does not permit the student to form an impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth, but it extends the conception of the Absolute Truth into the field of the so-called material energy. Everything created by the material energy can be dovetailed with the Absolute by an attitude of service, which is the essential part of living energy. The pure devotee of the Lord knows the art of converting everything into its spiritual existence by this service attitude, and only in that devotional way can the theory of pantheism be perfected. Jai. Om Jnana Tamirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Iti Namine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschityadeshitarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivas Adi Gaurabhakta Vinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I'd like to seek the blessings of all the exalted Vaishnavas assembled here today, and everybody who's also not assembled here today, who are online and from the past, present and future, and seek blessings so I can say something of something vaguely important or useful from the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is full of amazing things, and hope I don't ruin it by my presentation. Hare Krishna. Vancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya eva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Someone gave me one very important instruction once, that when you're trying to do books, I was finding it very difficult distributing books. And someone told me, Prabhu, all you need to do is get out of the way and let Krishna do his work. It's like, don't try to think, you know, you're the man who's making everything happen. Don't block the way with your own mental conceptions. Just get out of the way and it will happen. You just need to stop blocking yourself. So this, in this canto, first chapter, Sukhdeva Goswami starts answering questions that Maharaj Parikshit asked at the end of the previous canto. And essentially, just to recap a little bit, in verse 37, towards the end of the last canto, Maharaj Parikshit says, "You are the spiritual master of great saints and devotees. I am therefore begging you to show the way of perfection for all persons, and especially for one who is about to die." So we know that Parikshit Maharaj has been cursed to die in 7 days, which is a very, in one sense, it is a very fortunate situation, because he knows that he's got 7 days and now he can prepare. Most of us don't know. So it is indeed a very fortunate situation. I was giving a class yesterday for Ekadashi. They do these Ekadashi programs here now, which are good, very interesting, just to inspire people from the congregation to come and take part in Ekadashi. And it's very interesting. We were talking about how somebody asked a question that, you know, if even devotees go through so much suffering, okay, everybody goes through suffering, then what's the point of praying to Krishna to relieve oneself of suffering? Because the material world is full of suffering, isn't it? Ranchor Prabhu told me a story once that he was there in the room when Srila Prabhupada was giving class. And often what Prabhupada would do is, when somebody asks a question from the audience, he would just pick somebody randomly from the audience and say, "You answer." And you can imagine how nerve-wracking that would be. It's like you're trying to answer a philosophical question in front of Srila Prabhupada. And on this occasion, somebody asked a question. Can't remember what it was, but Srila Prabhupada picked Ranchor Prabhu from the audience and said, "You answer." And then he goes, my heart was beating like really fast, you know, like, what am I going to say? And he started thinking, and then he fumbled, and he thought in his mind, like thoughts were going really fast. And he goes, "Okay, let me just start speaking something and Krishna will inspire me to say something." And then he started off answering the question by saying, "Yeah, so Prabhu, you know, in this world, there is happiness and there is suffering." And Prabhupada cut him up straight away. He said, no happiness, only suffering. So sometimes you may think that the material world is designed for suffering. And sometimes people ask the question, "Well, what's devotional service going to do to me then? I'm a devotee. I thought when I become a devotee, all my suffering would stop and I would be really happy. But why isn't it stopping? Why am I still suffering?" But the point is that a devotee, in any situation, he remembers Krishna. That's the difference. Whereas somebody else, in a situation, they may not remember Krishna. In fact, because of the situation, they may even do bad things. But a devotee always does the right thing, and he sticks to his values. It doesn't matter what happens in his life. Okay, there will always be a reason. There will always be a very, very good reason to do the wrong thing. Okay, situations will happen in life and you will think, "I'm fully justified to do the wrong thing now. So many bad things have happened to me." There's always a good reason. But a devotee, doesn't matter what happens, good, bad, a devotee always remembers Krishna and always takes the path of bhakti yoga, follows Krishna, stays surrendered. And that is the fame of a devotee. There's no story in the Bhagavatam which says, such and such a person took up to Krishna consciousness and he lived happily ever after. In fact, the whole of Bhagavatam is full of stories of such and such a person become a devotee, and then he suffered and he suffered and he suffered and he suffered. Prahlad Maharaj, he became a devotee. You know, his father tried to kill him. Okay, if he hadn't, he had a very good reason to not be a devotee. He could be like, "Okay, I'll just skip this and then I'll be happy because that's what my father wants." He could have had all the comforts of life. But he suffered, okay? Dhruva Maharaj suffered. Okay, Pandavas, every single story you see from the Bhagavatam, they're always suffering. And then you'll think, "Okay, what's the deal here?" So the point is, but they never gave up their relationship to Krishna, they never gave up the surrender, and they stuck to the path of Krishna consciousness. And hence, when they gave up their body, or sometimes even in the same body, they ascended to the spiritual world. So that is a devotee. He always sticks to Krishna consciousness, even if there is a very, very good reason to give up his values. Okay, I just heard a story. When I started coming to Krishna consciousness, my father, he also got inspired. So I didn't really tell him anything about Krishna consciousness, but he naturally on his own, he was always looking for something spiritual. So he took up Krishna consciousness. In fact, he got initiated before me. And then he also got second initiated, and now he's 74 years old and he lives in an ashram. Okay, he's been living in an ashram for the past 6-7 years in Gujarat. So he told me a story. I didn't actually know. He finds out, he reads the Puranas, and he sometimes, like, he chants like 30-40 rounds a day, and he does service at the temple, and he reads all these Puranas and things, and he finds out all these stories, and then he tells me when I call him. So I like calling my dad. It's a very spiritual conversation. The rest of the family, I'm not sure, but with my dad, it's always good. So he told me a story which kind of opened up a lot of things for me from the Mahabharata. I'll just tell you very briefly. It was about Shakuni. You know, we always like Shakuni. He was actually, we can sort of say he was a bad guy, wasn't he? He was always like inciting Duryodhan, and he was always supporting him, telling him how he should take over the kingdom, and you know, how he should do this, that. In fact, you know, to some levels you can attribute all the destruction that happened to Shakuni somewhat. Okay, because he kind of made everything happen, the gambling match, he always won, he cheated. So you might think, why did Shakuni do that? It doesn't make sense. Like, what did he have to gain? He didn't get anything at the end of it. Like, everybody died, he didn't get anything. Did he die? Did Shakuni die? He dies, doesn't he? So what did he get? So my father told me the story. He goes, I was trying to research this. And he goes, Gandhari was born in, you know, in Kandahar, in Afghanistan, which is where you don't want to go right now. But in Afghanistan she was born. And her charts, according to her chart, she had like the wrong influence of planets. And it was said that if she marries somebody, he'll be a very powerful person or whatever, but they'll die very soon if she marries somebody. So then Gandhari's father thought, well, you know, we don't want that to happen, do we? So what is the solution? So they said, well, what you can do is you can get her married off to something like a tree or a goat or something, and then you kill it. So then, you know, that's dead, and then she can carry on with her life. So they married her off to a goat, Haribol, and then she carried on, and then she got married to Dhritarashtra. I don't suggest you do this, but if you have wrong things in your chart, but sometimes people do suggest. I know devotees who married like trees and like a small tree and then cut the tree or something. What's that? Really? Yeah, so there's an option there if you want. But so that's what they did. And then she got married off to Dhritarashtra. Now, when Dhritarashtra found out, he wasn't very happy. First of all, because they didn't tell him all of this. Secondly, because he was second choice. After a goat. So then he didn't really like it so much. So what he does is that he invites the whole family for dinner, and then he puts them in prison, including Shakuni, because he was also part of the family. And then he kind of starves them. He only used to give them like one handful of rice every day, and it wasn't enough. So what the family decides is, well, this way everyone's going to die. One by one they started dying. So they say, everyone's going to die. Why don't we just give everything to Shakuni and let him live? So if we all give our portion to him, then he'll live. And anyway, he can avenge us. You know, he can be the avenger. Okay, so they do that. So Shakuni lives, everybody else dies, but his father tells him that you should avenge our death. So that's why Shakuni, he was very much against the whole Kuru dynasty. Pandavas, Kauravas, it kind of seemed like he was on the side of the Kauravas, but he wasn't. He wanted them to die as well, and the Pandavas. And that's why he was always inciting war, and because he knew that when a war happens, he knew that the Kauravas had no chance of fighting against the Pandavas because they were very, very strong. And so he was always inciting war, and he made it happen in such a way that everybody was destroyed. Unfortunately, it didn't work because the Pandavas still lived, but most of the Kauravas died. And the reason why he had these dice that always worked for him was because he made that from the bones of his father. There's a lot of things you make from bones in the Bhagavatam as well, isn't it? So he took the bones of his father, and apparently the spirit of his father was in there. So his father gave him a blessing that if you use my bones to make these dice, they'll land on however you want it to land. So in the middle of the gambling match, he switched dice and he used those dice. And then so that's how he won the gambling match. So there was a backstory. Now, Shakuni had an option to be a bad guy, and he took that option. And he became a bad guy and he did a lot of things. But a devotee never takes that option, even though he has it. He always remains surrendered to Krishna. He never gives up his values. So that's very, very important. So Parikshit Maharaj here, he asks, what should one do? if one is about to die. And in answer to that, Sukadeva Goswami is speaking all of these things. Now, one important thing is that Srila Prabhupada explains that one should not be afraid of death. Okay, who here is afraid of death? Yeah, I'm afraid of death as well. We're all afraid of death. And it is explained that, why are people afraid of death? Why are you afraid? What is the fear? What is the actual source of the fear? Okay, death, we understand. But what is the actual fear? Attachment to the body, yeah. What else? What's going to happen afterwards? Anything else? Sorry, I can't hear you. Painful experience, okay.
The loss of everything we have, right now.
The
loss, lose everything we have right
now. Okay, the loss, the things that you lose, yeah. So it is explained, Prabhupada explains that the cause of that is fear. Okay, we're afraid, especially of, like Ruben Prabhu said, because of attachment to the body and belongings. Okay, attachment to the body and attachment to the belongings of the body. And because of this attachment, we're always in fear, okay, that we're about to lose something. And we have, you know, this fear. And because of this fear, what happens is that it cripples our mind. We're not able to think of Krishna at the time of death. Sukadeva Goswami explains that the greatest perfection is if one can think of Lord Krishna at the time of death. Okay, he explains that at the end of the first canto. But if you have this fear that we're always attached to our body, and if you're always attached to what belongs to our body, then we won't be able to think of Krishna because of this fear. So hence, Sukadeva Goswami explains, we shouldn't be afraid of death. Okay, we should be fearless at the time of death. And to help that, to help you free yourself of that fear at the time of death, there is a Varnashram system. And part of that is Vanaprastha. That you're actually giving up your belongings, okay, everything that belongs to you, including your house and your money and your wife and your family and whatever, and you go into the forest. So what is the purpose of that? Because if you're still attached to these things, if you're still attached to your belongings, then you won't be able to be fully conscious thinking of Krishna at the time of death. And hence, better to practice. Give yourself, you know, 20, 25 years to practice. Go into the forest, do something, you know, more spiritual. Stay awake from your belongings. And then your mind will become clear and you'll be able to think of Krishna. So the whole system is designed, so step by step, at the time of death, which is what Sukadeva Goswami says is the perfection of life, you can think of Krishna. But if you don't practice, then you won't. And hence it is said, everybody should take Vanaprastha. You don't have to take sannyas. Sannyas is only certain, it is said, brahmanas, kshatriyas, whatever. Brahmanas, isn't it? Brahmanas take sannyas. But Vanaprastha is for everybody. So hence we should aim for that. Hare Krishna. Everybody has anxieties of losing something. Okay. No. Just give me 1 second. Let me see what else we got. I said everything I wanted to say in 5 minutes. Another thing I was thinking also is that I was speaking to Brijesh Prabhu and the others on Janmashtami, and we came up with a very good idea that brahmachari life is very good. I spent about 10 years here, actually 11 if you count the 1 year I was here, even after I changed ashram and doing service. And it sounds like I'm blowing my trumpet, and I am, because it was nice. But I think everybody should, if you're capable, if you're capable, at least when you're single and you're young, everybody should do at least 1 year in the brahmachari ashram. And I think that'll be a very good contribution. You got nothing to lose. Okay, 1 year. People you waste years of their life, you know, doing random things. And at least if you do 1 year, imagine that. And we were talking about Pandavasena at that time. And I'm thinking, if everybody in Pandavasena is such a big, organization within ISKCON, lot of devotees in Pandavasena. If everybody just gave 1 year of their life, okay, to the ashram, and they dedicate that 1 year to fully preaching Krishna consciousness, imagine how big of an impact it would have, first of all, in the Hare Krishna movement, and in their own life, because they'll be trained in renunciation, they'll be trained in spiritual life. So, tell everybody, here's the news, okay? 1 year in the ashram, everybody who is young, isn't it, Sutta Prabhu? Actually, Paramakaruna is up for that. He likes that. I saw him in the shoe room once. There was a 4 or 5 year old kid, and he had kind of wandered off, and he was trying to convince him to join the ashram. while he was putting his shoes on, waiting for his father outside. So, yeah, 1 year in the ashram, I think it'll make a big difference to the Hare Krishna movement, and also in their own spiritual life. It's good training, because then it becomes easier to take Vanaprastha life, because you know what to expect. Shri Radha Gokulananda ki, Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Shri Gonita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Now in this verse, the important point made here is that somebody who is in the modes of passion and ignorance, okay, mode of ignorance, passion and ignorance, they can never understand the absolute truth. So here, Prabhupada writes that in the mode of passion and ignorance, it's very difficult to understand the absolute truth. The mode of goodness is calming, okay? Here Prabhupada writes, the mode of passion is agitating, and the mode of ignorance is bewildering. Okay, so someone in the modes of passion and ignorance can never understand the absolute truth, and hence we should make an endeavor to go to the mode of goodness, because mode of goodness is a very good platform to take up transcendental activities. You can still practice transcendental activities like hearing, chanting, doesn't matter what mode you're in. But interestingly, if you read this purport carefully, Prabhupada explains that those who are in the mode of passion and ignorance, if they take up spiritual activities, their concept of the absolute will always be impersonal. Prabhupada writes that. It's they'll have an impersonal understanding, and that's, they're called jnanis. Okay, they're into knowledge and renunciation and things like that. And impersonalism is what helps them. And then Prabhupada goes on to talk about pantheism. Does anyone know what pantheism is? What's that? Yes and no. Nature, yeah. So what they see is, they see, in simple terms, they see divinity and reality is the same. So Prabhupada writes here, they don't form an impersonal concept of the absolute, but they think that the whole universe is the absolute. Okay, that is God. The whole universe is God. It's like there's a lot of pantheism nowadays in the yoga crowd. Okay, they also, oh yeah, the universe told me to go into yoga. You know, the universe is always talking to me. I heard signs from the universe, and you know, the love and the light and all that. So that is kind of pantheism. They think the universe is God. Whatever the universe is, who knows? Okay, but the reality and divinity is the same for them. So that is pantheism. So that's kind of, Prabhupada explains, in the mode of passion and ignorance, that's the sort of concept of the absolute truth you will have. Even jnanis and impersonalists, they have this concept of impersonalism because they are in the modes of passion and ignorance. So if you want to understand the absolute truth, then you have to come to the mode of goodness. Or, here in the verse it is explained that if you take up to service of Vishnu, then doesn't matter what mode you're in, that concept will change. But you have to start doing personal service. So if you want to preach to the yoga crowd, okay, you have to, according to this verse, the way to help them understand a personal conception is to engage them in service. Okay, if you keep teaching them yoga, they'll do a lot of yoga, but their perception will always be impersonal. But if you engage them in service, and it is working, I think Kirtan London does a lot of work with yoga people, and they, you know, they come and then they do courses with them, and then they engage them in service, and it works. This devotee is coming from that. Even we do a lot of preaching here at the School of Bhakti and Krishna Wisdom, and I think service is the key. There's only so much. Philosophy is great. People will be convinced of philosophy, but sometimes I find that even after years and years of understanding of the philosophy, somewhere there is an impersonal sort of thing behind it. When I first came to Krishna consciousness and I was reading Prabhupada's books, there was everywhere, every other page, this, like, Prabhupada talks about Mayavad. And there's, you know, all these people are Mayavadis and Mayavadis. And I was like, I've been in India for all my life. I've never met a Mayavadi. Who's this Mayavadi? What's this impersonalism? I'd never heard of Mayavadis before I read Prabhupada's books. And I was like, who are these Mayavadis and impersonalists? But after I read that, you think in India everybody's a personalist because everybody's worshipping Ganesh or everybody's worshipping Shiva or Brahma or whoever, you know? And you think they're personalists, but they're not. Because after I read those books, when I would go to India and I would have philosophical conversations with my friends, you dig down deep and behind all the Vishnu worship, behind all the Shiva worship, or the Ganesh worship, it's all that. But they're all coming from the same energy. That's the underlying conception, isn't it? It's like, that's what they said, they're all the same, they're coming from the same energy. So they're like, even they don't know that they're impersonalists. It's very hidden. So service to Vishnu is the way as recommended here by Sukadeva Goswami and Prabhupada in the purport. But to rise to the mode of goodness also helps, rising to the mode of goodness. And we should arrange our lifestyle in such a way that we can slowly elevate ourselves to the mode of goodness. It's very, very important. Everything we do in life, any interaction that you have, affects you with one of the three modes. I was trying to... The best explanation of this I've heard or read is in one of Hridayananda Maharaj's books. There was... Hridayananda Maharaj has a version of the Bhagavad Gita where in the beginning he kind of explains all the different concepts from the Bhagavad Gita. And it's a very good explanation. And he talks about how you're sort of... when you have an interaction, you're trading your free will with that mode of nature. For example, if you have an interaction, if you have an experience in the mode of passion, okay, you're sort of trading with free will. When we come to this world, we don't come with anything. The only thing you have is free will. So that's your currency. Okay, free will is your currency. Okay, and any experience you have to buy that experience with the only currency you have, that is free will. So if you have an experience in the mode of passion, you're trading some of your free will to the mode of passion. So hence what it means is you're being more influenced by the mode of passion and you're losing that little bit of free will, which means you'll be forced to act that little bit in the mode of passion. So the more experiences you have, the more things you do interacting with the lower modes, the more you're losing your free will to these modes, which means when it comes to a situation when you have to make a certain decisions, you lost that sort of free will to passion and ignorance, and your decision will inevitably be forced by those two modes. So you'll end up making a decision in mode of passion and ignorance, which can never lead you to transcendence. So even the experiences we have, we should be very, very careful. And some things influence us more than others. And the reason prasadam is so much... hence the reason why prasadam is very, very important. Because Prabhupada said that even if they don't accept any philosophy, give them prasadam. Why did he say that? Because prasadam is, of course, it's mode of goodness, but it's also transcendental. And it'll affect them in more than one way, the spiritual way, but also it'll help them rise to a level where they can actually understand the philosophy. So give them prasadam like that. So food, you have to be very, very careful what goes into your mouth, because it can affect the way you think. You're trading your free will there by putting things in your mouth. And in the ashram it's okay because, you know, somebody cooks for us and it's all offered and it's ready. Somebody does the brahmachari transfer as well. It's straight up there in the ashram. All you have to do is take your plate and eat it. So it's fine. But when you go outside, I found out when I moved out, oh my God, this is a whole big thing. I have to actually go and buy food. Then somebody has to cook it. Then you have to offer it. And then you can actually eat it. It's a very long process that actually takes quite a few hours. I didn't realize. I thought, oh, Brahmacharya, somebody does a transfer, you go there. I was afraid of queues. I hate queuing. So I was like, I can't be bothered queuing up for prasadam, you know. So my biggest fear was queuing, but I didn't realize that actually someone has to buy food, cook it, offer it in order to be available on your plate so you can eat it. It actually takes a good 2-3 hours, you know. So it's actually a big endeavor. But out there you have to be really careful. There's so many things that you could eat that you shouldn't be eating. So we have to be very, very careful what we buy, what we eat. And since most of our crowd here is not here, but in ISKCON and in the Hare Krishna movement, and probably the people listening to this class are living outside, I just want to say that be careful what you buy. There's a lot of dodgy things out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects your, it affects how you think, what goes into you. Also what you watch. Now again, doesn't apply here, but out there, sometimes people do watch a bit of television. But you have to be careful what you watch, because even that affects how you think, and what mode you're in. So things like that, we have to be very careful, because the modes of nature define how much your understanding of the Absolute Truth will be. Hare Krishna. What else can I say? I think I'm done. Do we have any questions? Ruben Prabhu, yes, please, thank you. Is there a mic?
Yes.
Thank you for a very nice class.
Thank you.
Could you elaborate a little bit? You were saying how the devotees are suffering and suffering and suffering.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on what the devotees' attitude is towards suffering, and if they practice devotional service, do they suffer? Should they be aspiring to stop suffering? What's the attitude of a devotee towards suffering?
Thank you, Prabhu. So Ruben Prabhu is saying that, what is the attitude of a devotee who is suffering? Should they aspire to not suffer? I think it's okay to aspire to not suffer. We don't want to suffer. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, is it Bhagavad Gita? Akama sarva kama va moksha kama udaradi tivrena bhakti yogena vrajeta purusham param. Says everything, doesn't matter what happens, one should always depend on Krishna and not on other things. What is a devotee's attitude towards suffering? Different things have been mentioned. One of the things is that a devotee sees that any suffering that comes is because his own misdeeds from the past. So a devotee sees it like that and he just tolerates it. That is also given in many, many places, that he sees, okay, because of my karmic reactions I'm suffering, and hence I will go through it, but let me just practice Krishna consciousness. Another way is that sometimes people accept voluntary suffering, voluntary austerity, because when you practice austerity, you are actually burning up your karma. But when you voluntarily do it, you can do it in such a way that you're utilizing it in Krishna's service. For example, if you take austerity to go and preach Krishna consciousness, you're kind of suffering, you know, standing on the street for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day and distributing books is a lot of suffering. So you voluntarily accepted that suffering, which means you're burning out your karma, but at the same time you're taking spiritual progress, you're making spiritual progress, and you're taking the holy name everywhere. So it's a win-win situation. And hence a devotee should always aspire to take on some tapa, like sutapa, Prabhu. Like, that's what the name means, somebody who takes a lot of austerity, and rightly so. So we should all take up voluntary austerity, because we're going to suffer anyway, because of our karma or whatever it may be. Might as well just do it voluntarily, but use it in Krishna's service. Sometimes a devotee, but the main attitude mentally of a devotee is that, doesn't matter what happens, let whatever suffering is due to me, let it come, but I'll never budge from my devotional practice. Doesn't matter what situation I'm in, I'll carry on Krishna consciousness. But if you want to pray to relieve suffering, that is also okay. That is also a good prayer to do for Krishna, to relieve your suffering. In fact, Bhakti Yoga destroys your karma anyway. So it will. If devotees are suffering, it means they're suffering a lot less than they would if they weren't practicing Krishna consciousness. Thank you, Prabhu.
So would it be fair to say that when someone engages, when they're suffering, they get a higher taste so that they can tolerate that suffering that comes to them?
Someone engages in Krishna consciousness. Yeah, I guess so. I think so. I think Sutta Prabhu has a comment or something.
Thank you, Prabhu. Just a follow-up to this. I was just thinking about this. It would be nice to have your understanding. When we go through life and there's suffering, then what we tend to do is... take on some material situation in order to alleviate that suffering so that we can focus on spiritual life. So I was thinking, in the bhakti path, is it that as time goes by, we should be trying to utilize those material arrangements less and less and increase our pain threshold, like our tolerance threshold? Or is it more important in the bhakti path that as time goes by, it doesn't matter, just use whatever you need to use, just focus on sadhana and spiritual kind of positive absorption in Krishna? Or should we actively be trying to increase our tolerance of pain and become less and less reliant upon material, interim material solutions that help to... Does that understand?
Yeah. What I'm saying? Yeah. Thank you, Sutta Prabhu. I don't know why you're asking me the question, but my understanding is Srila Prabhupada said that the advancement of a devotee is measured, something along those lines, based on how detached he becomes from material things. Prabhupada said that, didn't he?
Ability to tolerate provoking situations.
That's one. Ability to tolerate provoking situations. But he also said his advancement can be measured on how detached he becomes from material things. So I think as you advance in Krishna consciousness, by Krishna conscious practice, I think naturally it induces detachment. Sometimes we use things, but we're not relying on them. We're not attached to them, but we use things because they're favorable in Krishna consciousness. And I think a devotee would know if he is attached to something and he kind of is relying on something and using it, or if he's using it, he's not attached, but it's favorable in Krishna consciousness. I think if one is, I think it comes naturally by practice, by advancing in Krishna consciousness. I think naturally we become detached from material things a lot. But you're saying, should we actively try to be detached, and should we actively try to be more renounced? Is that your question?
Yeah, it just seems to me that, at least if I look at my life, it's not like an active meditation to try and reduce my reliance upon material things.
Yeah.
If it happens naturally, it happens naturally. But it's not like I'm not really thinking in that way. I'm more thinking about how I can be more positively absorbed in Krishna consciousness. But what I'm wondering is that, is there a value to a devotee thinking like that? That, you know, as time goes by, I should try and rely less and less on material solutions to help me be Krishna conscious. In other words, I should try to reduce that.
Okay, so I don't know if there's a philosophical answer to this, but my opinion is that if we just focus on Krishna consciousness, and if we, at the same time, we should be willing to take austerities for the sake of spreading Krishna consciousness everywhere. But if we wholeheartedly give ourselves to bhakti yoga and practice of Krishna consciousness, I think the detachment will naturally come. I think it naturally comes. But that's my understanding. But some people may want to take on voluntary austerity, and I think there's nothing wrong with that if they want to. I think it just depends on, different people are different. So I think Prayojana Prabhu had a comment.
It's one question I remember was asked to Prabhupada: how do I know that I'm doing things with a pure motive? You know, that somehow it's not got some false ego or... and he said, if you're self-motivated, or he says the difference between you know, your pure motive and your impure motive is that you'll suffer, because if you're doing it so that I'm a great Sankirtan leader, I'm a great singer, I'm a great, you know, this and that, then you'll suffer. That's it. You'll just suffer. You'll just continue to suffer because you're just fulfilling your false ego. And you know, when people don't give you praise, then you'll suffer.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a good way of knowing your motive.
Yeah.
You know, you just suffer. You know, you to be disappointed with this, disappointed with this. They're like this, they're like that.
Yeah.
You know, your motivation is not pure. Okay.
Thank you, Prabhupada. I think Harika Mataji has a question.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. I'm just confused about one thing, which is like, how much austerity should we take voluntarily, and how do we know how, like, there's that component of health. Like, for example, when we were studying Bhakti Shastri, the teachers were discussing with us, I know we're not the body, we're the soul, but we have a body. So they were suggesting that women should not take a lot of austerities because it makes their heart very hard. And on the other hand, they advise men to take more austerities because it makes their heart very soft. So, like, in that context, if you're taking this, you know, austerities, and like you're living in the ashram, and there's anyway naturally a lot of austerities, how do you know how much suffering to take and when, where to stop, where it's healthy for you? Is there like a line that's given in the shastras, or you just have to know, how do you know that this much austerity is enough for me?
Okay, thank you. We're not going out looking for suffering, because that'll come anyway. But we just the point is that we should take up some amount of austerity for spreading Krishna consciousness, for helping others in bhakti yoga, obviously in a Krishna conscious way. And I think everybody has their limits, and I think everybody knows it's a different line for everybody. There's not one line that everybody crosses. Everybody has a different line based on their, you know, whether, like you said, whether they're men or women, or based on their health, or based on their age, or based on their tolerance levels. I think everybody has a different sort of line. Like some devotees can just stay and just stay, do books for like 8 hours a day, you know, on the street 6 times a week. But I know I couldn't do that. I did that for a while, but it was too much for me, so then I moved on to something else. So I think everybody has a different line. And as long as you're trying your best, I think that's good. I mean, I don't know, there's no number I can give you, or there's no there's no measurement I can give you, but I think you just know when it's your limit.
So if something doesn't compromise your health, then you should continue that austerity. If something, because a lot of times devotees compromise their health.
Yeah.
They'll just be like, no, I'm just going to do it for Krishna.
Yeah.
And then you get into that mood.
Yeah.
And then you continuously go like that. And then, of course, there'll be a point where they like completely collapse.
Yeah.
So this whole idea of health, how important it is in our Krishna consciousness.
Yeah, I would say, please look after your health. Because it'll help you, and you can practice Krishna consciousness for longer. We need to at least do the basics, and look after our health. In an emergency, sometimes we may have to push a little bit, like Janmashtami, like for the festival. Okay, sometimes in an emergency, but you can't keep an emergency situation for the whole of your life. So in an emergency, sometimes you may need to push a little bit more. But generally, we should definitely look after our health first, because that's what is our sort of commodity. If we have that, then we can practice Krishna consciousness properly.
Thank you. Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. So in the starting, you know, you said that there was the story of Gandhari, where you gave the story of her astrology was not good, and then she had to. Is that done in the mode of in a goodness, or is that astrology in the mode of goodness, or is it in the mode of passion? Like, should we be practicing that kind of activities for elevating ourselves in Krishna consciousness?
Yeah, Well, good question. Is astrology in the mode of goodness, passion, or ignorance? I don't know. I don't think astrology is in any mode. I think it's just what we do with it. You can deal with it in a mode of passion, goodness, or ignorance. Obviously, what she did didn't really sound like the mode of goodness. It sounded like, you know, marrying a goat and then chopping his head off isn't really mode of goodness. So it's some of the lower modes. I think Prabhupada said, as far as astrology is concerned, he said different things. Sometimes he said that, yeah, one should look at astrology, especially for marriage and sannyas. He said that. But in other times he also said that, yeah, we don't worry about astrology. Krishna with one kick, he can kick out all the bad influences. So he even said that. So I think it's personal discretion to use astrology. It can be useful. It doesn't matter so much to me, at least. If you think it's useful for you, then use it. But if not, as long as ultimately Krishna is the top of the game, and if you please Krishna, then he'll look after you.
Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. I think Prabhu first. Are you standing there because you're trying to leave?
No, that's the question.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's,
Thank you for class, Prabhu.
So you mentioned, like, obviously it's easier to practice things within the man living within the ashram itself.
Yeah.
And in the outside world, sometimes we don't have a choice to be, like, exposed, right? To, like, television, in an example you said.
Yeah.
How can we reduce the impact of that influence?
I just remembered something really funny when you said television. It's like some... My wife was listening to Jai Pataka Maharaj giving class, and somebody asked him a question. I don't know why he would even ask that question. He asked him a question: Maharaj, can we watch TV on Ekadashi? And Maharaj said, yes. He goes, but just don't switch it on. So, yeah, how can we reduce the impact of what television...
Just in general, like a...
Just modes of nature. Like that? Just like different influences and TV and people. I think you have to choose your association and you have to choose what you do. If you find that certain things are influencing you a lot more, and if you feel like, you know, it's becoming difficult for you to practice Krishna consciousness in a certain situation, then if you see that Krishna consciousness is going down, then you should try to change it. I think you have to choose where you want to be. If you really, you know, your work situation or whatever, I think everybody has to judge on their own. If it's affecting them too much, then we should definitely make an endeavor to change it. Sometimes you don't make an endeavor out of fear that, oh my God, this, I really hate my work, I really hate my work, I hate my work, I hate my work, but I don't want to go because where else am I going to go? But it's really affecting my Krishna consciousness. It's not right. Why am I making chicken sandwiches at work? You know, it's really affecting my Krishna consciousness. I did that as a part-time job once at uni. But anyway, so I moved away from that because it wasn't helping me. But that time I wasn't practicing so well. But I'm just saying that if you see that something is really influencing you a lot and it's affecting your Krishna consciousness, then yeah, we should try and change the situation. We should, when you watch TV, you should choose what you're going to watch. I'm not saying you should watch TV, but I'm just saying that some people do, and you should be very careful what you watch and what you do and where you are. It's you're on your own there. It's like navigating through a forest, and you have to avoid all the wild animals. You know, that's that. But it's your responsibility to do that.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Yes, Ben Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the class, Prabhu. It was very nice. I specifically like the point where you talk about our free will being like a currency,
yeah,
which we're exchanging with the different material modes, which is,
yeah,
is our choice at the end of the day. We can find a Krishna consciousness is very difficult to be in the mode of goodness, especially in ashram life, because we're always doing this and that and this and that, very mode of passion orientated.
Yeah.
And as you explained, the Prabhupada explained the Prabhupada, we need to be in the mode of goodness,
yeah,
to actually understand Krishna and to be able, yeah, to be personal. So how can we reconcile, living such a busy life, but being able to be in the mode of goodness? How is that possible? So on that kind of, just the question around that is, what are the main impediments in being in mode of goodness in Krishna consciousness?
Now goodness, I don't think goodness means you're just sitting around chanting and just not doing any activity. I think there is activity in goodness as well. Where there is no activity is in the mode of ignorance, when you're just not doing anything because you're bewildered. But I think there is activity in both goodness and passion, whereas with passion that activity is motivated by hankering and, you know, personal desire and selfish gain. That's what it's motivated by. But in goodness also there is activity, but it's motivated not for personal reasons, but for selfless reasons. And activity in Krishna consciousness is not necessarily mode of passion. If you're running around doing field work, you know, or whatever, or you're doing book distribution or whatever, certain activities you may be doing, which may sound look like the mode of passion, but it's not. It's transcendental activity because it's being done for the Supreme Lord, and that's not going to increase your mode of passion like that. So it's not that activity is just in passion. Activities are in goodness as well, with a different motive. And especially activity, service for Krishna, even though it's active service, it's not really mode of passion, it's transcendental. So that won't... You're not trading your free will there. You're trading your free will with Krishna there. It's transcendental activity, so that's good.
Thank you.
Yes, David Prabhu.
Prabhu, thank you for the class, Prabhu. My question is about austerity, and I'm wondering if austerity is something that we can perceive only through a conditioned perspective.
Okay. So is austerity something that we can perceive only through a conditioned perspective?
Yes, like through our own conditioning, it may seem austere, but...
Oh, okay. Like, okay. Yeah. Is it subjective? Like is, you know, for me, according to me, this is austere, but for somebody else it may not be austere like that? Yeah, it's very much like that, because everybody is different. Everybody is different. There's no absolute line for this is austere and anything beyond below this you're spacing out. It's not like that. It's everybody has different... Austerity is different for everybody. Everybody has a different range of austerity based on the situation and their mentality, their work, their situation in society. Everybody's austerity is different. Living in the ashram, even then austerity is different for everybody based on the situation. So it's something you will know. It's an individual game. There's no one line for austerity. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, and just like also in terms of like Narada Muni.
Yeah.
Like when I heard that he was attacked like even by a sword, and because it just went through him, that there's no, that like in terms of energy and the body, if there is actually no austerity in terms of fatigue or anything, on an absolute sense, that it's only something in a conditioned state where austerity is perceived.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know, I don't have the answer to that. Okay, so if someone... Do you experience austerity only in the conditioned state of existence? Is that the question?
Yes, a true conditioned.
Okay, do people in the liberated stage experience austerity? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. Do people in the spiritual world experience austerity? I think Prayojan Prabhu has an answer.
Class for Prabhupada, where she, a mother, she asked a poor devotee. You said that there is suffering. You know, when he was explaining his difficulty with his heart condition and his own health, and she said, "But I thought you said the pure devotee doesn't suffer." And he said, he answered that, and he said, yes, there is suffering. But there is not so much suffering. I was chanting, you were chanting. together we were chanting to, you know, you were trying to chant to help me, and I was chanting to get well again for preaching. So, yes, there is suffering, but it's minimized because we were all chanting with not a personal motive. But for service sake,
yeah,
you know. So there is, it's just there,
yeah.
And so even the pure devotee will experience a suffering, but because of the nature of the remedy was actually in Krishna consciousness,
yeah,
you know, and acceptance. Of, that he's come to this material world, and that there isn't anybody who doesn't suffer to yeah. some degree.
Yeah.
You know, like we're talking about health and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, so like Prabhupada, he had to go back to India for a while.
Mm.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Thank you, Prabhu. Thank you. David Prabhu, do you have your answer? I think the point is that in the material world, everybody will suffer, but it's just a devotee relies on Krishna and that. You know, then there's not so much suffering. Ruben Prabhu? I think Ruben Prabhu has. Sorry, if you need to go, you can go. I was just asked to go on longer because breakfast is not till 9:30. I'm not going to go till 9:30. We'll finish soon.
Just Ashri Dhamraj, when he was leaving his body, he said something very relevant to your point. He said, suffering is, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. Because suffering is created by the mentality we have to a situation. But pain is something that we may experience. But
yeah.
the suffering that may come with that pain, that's down to the way that we perceive it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that may help in that regard.
Yeah. Thank you, Ruben Prabhu. Pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Thank you. Is it? Prayojan Prabhu is. Okay. Okay.
It's not necessary that we've got more time.
Okay. Okay.
That they're going to move in at 9:30.
Sure.
You know, so actually we have to clean the place.
Sure.
Before they come. So sorry to point that out, but it's a practical consideration because they'll be waiting there.
Okay.
When we're cleaning, oh, it's okay, we start cleaning at 9:30.
Sure.
When they're waiting outside.
Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.